May it please the court, Lee Rosser, registration number 39598. I represent the appellant, Lene Haida. For ease of reference, during the argument, I'm going to refer to Ms. Haida as mother and the appellee, Mr. Setmeyer, as father. This appeal stems from a dissolution of marriage action that was originally heard in Eagle County District Court by the Honorable Judge Moorhead. My brief encompasses multiple issues, which I don't have time to touch on today, so I'm going to focus on a few narrow issues. The first one is the parenting plan that was submitted by father, this proposed parenting plan. And I know that the court has read the briefs, but to just briefly recap, the court entered a final order. Well, it wasn't a final order. It was findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order. That happened on November 14th. It contained a parenting plan in that. The court also directed father's counsel to submit a proposed parenting plan within 3 days, which he did. And then the court basically rubber stamped that proposed parenting plan 2 days later.
Ms. Ross, can you help me understand? I'm sorry. Yeah. I was puzzled and I checked the record. Why was the court asking for a parenting plan, given that the, and my question is there anything in the record indicating why the court was asking for something more when the findings kind of covered, had a plan in it? I was very confused.
Your Honor, exactly. And any answer I could give to that would just be speculation.
And so there's nothing in the record indicating why the court requested that?
There's not. And if you looked at the actual order part of the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order, which I'm just going to call the final order for my purposes. It was very detailed. The order portion, I think I said in my brief, 35 sentences out of 40 were devoted to the parenting plan. So it is confusing why they did that. But mother did not have the chance to respond to that. And if it had essentially mirrored the parenting plan set forth within the final order, then the error would have been harmless and you know, everybody could have moved on, but it didn't. It was substantially different. It reduced the frequency of contact from 4 days to 11 days during the school year. And in my brief, I said that it gave roughly the same amount of overnights, but it didn't. If you really look closely at it, the regular parenting time under the final order was about 140 some odd regular parenting overnights. Under father's proposed parenting plan, there were only 92. So that was a pretty big difference.
Ms. Rosser, before you go on, I know that your position is that it was not a final order, even though sometimes you might be referring to it as a final order. But my question for you is your argument dependent upon that being a final order?
It's absolutely not, and I was actually going to touch on that. There was a lot of discussions in the briefs whether this was a final order. My client maintains that the November 14th order was, but at the end of the day, I don't think that that's central to this argument at all. I mean, the bottom line is that father's counsel submitted something to the court. It contained this rationale, which basically was a reasoning why the court should overturn its previous order. And that rationale, we assert, amounts to argument. It was kind of like a petition for the court to reconsider what it already found to be in the child's best interest. So whether it was final or not, the bottom line is mother didn't have the chance to respond or object. And that's where the error was. And the error was pretty plain, and it was not harmless because it did affect her substantial right.
Ms. Rosser, let me ask you, you've mentioned twice that mother did not have the chance to respond. And I noticed in the briefs that there was a comment that there was no evidence of any notice to mother about this proposed new parenting time plan. Are you saying there was just no evidence in the record, or there was actually no opportunity to respond?
The problem was twofold. The one problem was it was never served on mother, so she really didn't have notice, okay? But then when the court violated CRCP 121-116 by rubber stamping it 2 days later, then it also denied mother of the amount of time she should have had pursuant to the rules to respond. So it was twofold. It was that she never was served with the proposed order, and also that the court didn't allot her time to respond before it basically just signed off on it. And, you know, we would argue that when the court accepted these substantial changes without giving mother any opportunity to respond and really no explanation for the reason why it directly contradicted what it had said about extracurricular decision making and the final order versus the parenting plan, had all these new restrictions on her travel outside of Eagle County. And I don't know that this is important, but the order itself was so overwhelmingly in favor of father, which that was the court's opinion of the case. But then when something like this happens after the fact, that basically changes things even more in favor of father without giving mother any opportunity, it just, you know, I would argue in the case law that I present in the brief supports it, that it undermined the fairness of the whole proceedings to such an extent that really that proposed parenting plan has to be reversed, absolutely. But quite potentially that it just, it was so improper that really the whole decision should be reversed because it creates an appearance of bias, and mother just didn't have the opportunity to respond at all.
Mr. Oster, let me ask you this: if we were to accept your argument that the new proposed parenting time plan had to be reversed or vacated, what effect would that have on other decisions made by the trial court with regard to parental responsibility and primary residential parent, if any?
Well, as I have stated, mother believes that it really calls into question the fairness of the entire proceedings.
Well, let me ask you, follow up. I understand the argument. You say there's bias, it calls into question the whole thing, so we should undermine that. I mean, I think there's some law that would suggest if the bias comes from the evidence in the case itself, that's not a disqualifying bias. I'm not sure there's even a motion to recuse. So let's put that aside for a second. But following up on Judge Hawthorne's question, if we were to do what you ask and to get rid of the parenting plan, by way of example, does that bring back the court's parenting plan, or do we need to start all over, or what's the remedy?
I think at the very least that the proposed parenting plan has to be reversed, and at the very least it would need to revert back to the parenting plan contained in the final orders. I think that there is a strong argument on the parenting issue that the parenting issues in general should be reversed.
Right. And now on the parenting time, let me ask you a separate question. So let's put the parenting time issues aside for a second. And this is, I think, where Judge Hawthorne was going. I had the same question on decision making, et cetera, separate from the bias question. Is there any reason, were we to agree with you and say the parenting time needs to be reconsidered, that this argument also impacts the decision-making responsibility, say?
It impacts the decision-making responsibilities as far as extracurricular activities without a doubt, because the court changed what it had originally stated was in the child's best interest, which is that each party should be able to make decisions for the child regarding extracurriculars during their parenting time, to father having sole decision-making with no rationale for that change whatsoever.
So to the extent that it speaks to the same issues, your argument is it should revive the court's original order?
At the least.
Okay. And then as to other issues, such as child support, that wouldn't impact that?
No.
Setting aside your bias argument.
Yes. I do not think child support is affected.
Right. I got to interrupt you again, Ms. Rosser. I'm sorry. You said at the least a couple of times here, and I mean, I guess we want to know what your position is on, you know, you say at the least, or maybe you go back to that order. I mean, is it your position we should go back there or not?
I think that here's the issue. It goes back to one of my other arguments about inconsistencies of findings, okay? If what the court was saying in parts of the parenting plan was true, and they had already made these other findings in the final order, then there's just kind of these inconsistencies and contradictions throughout, and I really think that the whole thing needs to be revisited.
All right, so your position is revisit
yes,
all the parenting time.
That's correct. Briefly, I just want to, when we're talking about child support, talk about another financial issue, and that basically is the inconsistencies of the court's finding in regard to the party's financial positions. And so if you look at the court's findings, their finances are mentioned throughout that final order. But when you kind of put them all together, this is basically what the court says. Mom has been financially dependent on father. She can't pay her bills without the financial assistance of father. It's important that if you look at her sworn financial statement, her bills were only for the most basic necessities of life, rent, utilities. I think she had less than $200 in debt payments. So the court says she can't meet even these most basic things on her own, but then they say that she doesn't meet the first prong of the threshold determination for maintenance, that she can meet her needs through appropriate employment. But there was never any argument that mother was underemployed. It was never discussed imputing income to her. And I think that part of the flaw in the court's logic was they kept talking about how much she could earn whenever she graduated, she earned her degree. Well, mother was only asking for maintenance until she finished her degree, and the evidence was also undisputed that the parties had agreed that it made sense for mom to stay at home and to take care of the child and go to school rather than work. So I think that if you believe the court that she couldn't even pay her bills, these basic bills, well, then she absolutely met the threshold test for maintenance.
And the threshold test requires us to look at her situation in that moment in time, right?
Correct.
Not in the future.
Exactly. And there's case law, a lot of case law that supports that. And it's the same thing with father. They seem to say, well, we don't know if he can meet his reasonable needs or not, but he absolutely could. At the time of the decree, I think that the court, which is speculation, was thinking, does dad have enough money to meet his reasonable needs for the rest of his life because of his age? But that was not the proper consideration. And he made the same amount as mother, but he had, according to his sworn financial statement, he had $834,000 in assets. And if you look at that carefully, almost half a million of that was designated as cash accounts, so that was liquid. He absolutely had the ability to meet not only his own reasonable needs, because the court said he could meet the child's. If he could meet the child's, he could meet his own. And he had the ability to help mom in the limited amount for the short amount of time that she was requesting it. And then as far as standard of living during the marriage, it was also undisputed that dad paid all of her bills for Pilates, for classes, for computers. He gave her gas money. He paid for her clothes. And he testified to that himself. And then quickly, I just also want to talk about attorney's fees and then hopefully save a couple of minutes. Abuse of discretion is the high standard, but it is really difficult to believe that another reasonable trier of fact could look at the disparity between these two parties' financial circumstances and not think that an additional award of attorney's fees was necessary to equalize the position. I just talked a little bit about dad's financial position, plus he had two vehicles. Mother had no car. She's much younger than him. She didn't have a college degree. She had virtually no savings, no assets. And even though he had paid some fees to her previously, that was predicated on us having a two-day trial, and we ended up having a four-day trial. And in large part, that was because dad called multiple expert witnesses, and it was just something beyond the control of mother, certainly.
Good afternoon. My name is Wendell Porterfield, attorney registration number 5881, appearing on behalf of the appellee William Sepmeyer. In domestic relations cases such as this, the courts are given more discretion, I believe, than in almost any other area of the law, primarily because the application of the statute is dependent on the facts, and it's also dependent upon the emotions of the parties, which are always going to run high in a domestic relations case. Excuse me. In this case, the wife, the mother, alleges that everything the trial court did was wrong. substantially everything in the case she believes was wrong, and she wants this court to reverse it. But because the court did not abuse its discretion in this case, and on the record did consider all of the statutory factors and made findings of fact and conclusions of law, it's our position that the judgment should be affirmed.
Let me jump in here, Mr. Porterfield, and ask you the same questions we were asking Ms. Rosser. Can you help me understand, we have a parenting plan in the findings and conclusions. You know, that was pretty specific. You get the child this week, dad, you know, the other one will have it on the weekend, then we're going to switch and go back and forth. I don't think there can be any legitimate question that what you submitted was totally different than that. And then the court said, well, what you submitted was more specific. I'm just being candid with you. I don't see it as more specific. I see it as different. And so a couple of questions. First, can you maybe help me understand what was the process? Is there anything in the record as to why the court, what the court was asking for from you that was more different? I would appreciate your addressing whether, in fact, the other side had a chance to look at it before the court ruled. And then maybe you can help me understand what the court was thinking, because what I'm seeing is one order that says one thing and then a different order that says something completely different, and I'm puzzled.
Let me tell you
that, I can help you if I lost you along the way.
Let me tell you that I'm limited in my ability to respond to some of your questions because I was not trial counsel. I am relying on the record, and I cannot answer the questions why. But as you are aware, the statute provides that either party may submit a proposed parenting plan. And in this case, both the mother and the father submitted parenting plans to the court.
Before the court ruled, right?
Before the court ruled, as okay. part of their pretrial presentation. But the statute at 1410.124.7 says that the court may approve its own parenting plan. And it goes on to outline additional things that are required to be in the parenting plan. And in fact, the state judicial has a form of parenting plan that's very comprehensive. It is not just that you will have visitation on this day or that day, but there are a number of factors that are to be considered by the court, and they're specifically set out in 124 subsection 7 as A, B, C, D, E, and F. And so while the court did make some specific findings in its order, you'll also recognize that at the time the order was entered, the child was attending school in Vail, that the father was awarded custody, and the order contemplates that he is going to enroll the minor child in another school in Gypsum, which is a fair distance from Vail, at the end of the next semester. And so the court left in place the visitation that had essentially been put in place at temporary orders, and didn't talk about this new parenting plan until the next school started, or the next semester started. I cannot tell you whether the rationale that set forth in the parenting plan was done by the court or whether it was done in the order that was submitted, because in the court's November findings of fact, it directed father's counsel to submit a parenting plan in editable form. I don't know whether, in fact, the trial court edited it or not. I do not know, and I can't represent to you whether the rationale was that of the judge or whether it was that put in by trial counsel.
Can you tell, or do you know, and I did know you were not trial counsel, but you I was using was the kind of formal you, I guess. Do you know whether mom is correct that mom didn't see this, the parenting plan that was submitted, until after the court signed it?
As an officer of the court, I will believe Ms. Rosser if she says she did not see it. But clearly, she saw it immediately, or she should have seen it immediately after the court issued the order. And the child in this case was born in November 2006. So at the time the court's order was entered, the child was right around 6 years old. And if this was really such an important change, it seems to me that Mother could have addressed it immediately with the court to create a record or to bring to the court's attention why she thought she did not have the opportunity to respond and do something.
Well, Mr. Porterfield, let me ask about the second part of Mother's argument here, is that the court didn't allow Mother the allotted time by rule to respond or object.
I cannot answer that question. But nevertheless, if she did not have sufficient time, she could have clearly gone back to the trial court and simply said, here is an opportunity for me to respond. And to me, that is important given the age of the child and now given the passage of time and things that have happened. So this issue, and I know they don't have to be addressed in the notice of appeal, but this issue is not even set forth in the notice of appeal, suggesting at some level that perhaps the order and the parenting plan was not considered until later on in this matter. I agree that everyone should be given the opportunity to respond, to make an argument. Here, the court did not allow sufficient time, but that's not necessarily grounds to reverse this case and send it back. The court did enter an order. The court was the finder of fact. The court entered extensive findings of fact and sat through a trial that proceeded over a total of 4 days or bits of 4 days, and then entered an order that was comprehensive and it believed to be fair under the circumstances.
Mr. Porterfield, I think I hear you saying that Mother did not challenge the fact that she didn't have sufficient time to respond to the proposed parenting time. She didn't challenge it in a timely manner. Is that what you're saying?
She did not challenge it in a timely manner, particularly given the fact that it is central to her argument now that somehow the court was biased against her, did something without giving her the opportunity to be able to object. And she had an opportunity to do it right then. And she chose not to avail herself of that. Now, that doesn't disqualify her from raising the issue on appeal, but it seems to me that given the age of the child, and the issues that are being addressed now, that was the time to do it.
So you're saying that there was no, the way I understand what you're saying, there was no motion for reconsideration or any other type of post-judgment relief sought other than the filing of the notice of appeal that resulted in this case?
That is correct.
Case before
that
us.
Is correct. If I could address the issue of maintenance, maintenance in this case was decided under the older statute, the preceding statute. And under that statute, there are enumerated a number of things that, a number of relevant factors that the court is to consider. The court considered all of those, the standard of living established during the marriage, the duration of the marriage. Now, this was a marriage that on the record was very short, and there had been, according to the judge's findings, one prior petition for dissolution of marriage that had been dismissed. I believe in the permanent orders hearing, there's a suggestion that there were two other petitions for dissolution. So this is not a marriage of long duration under any set of circumstances where the parties had established some long-standing standard of living. And the determination of maintenance, whether it should be awarded and the amounts, are left to the sound discretion of the trial court. And I do not believe that on this record it can be said that the court abused its discretion in declining to award additional maintenance. At temporary orders, there was an award of maintenance to the wife, but the statute is clear that the standards are different for that, and that that does not prejudice either party when you get to permanent orders.
Would you, Mr. Porterfield, address the issue that Ms. Rosser raised about the seeming inconsistency in the court's findings? I mean, it is absolutely true. The court said, on the one hand, in one place in the order, you know, mom was dependent on dad. She doesn't have any assets. She didn't get any marital property here because it was all separate. And on the other hand, the court says, and mom will be able to make money after and she'll be fine. That, number one, does seem somewhat inconsistent, but I'm persuadable. And number two, I'd appreciate your addressing it. Sounds like the court was looking at what mom could earn in the future, and I think the law is the court needed to look at what was happening right at that moment in time. Could you address those issues?
I think the award of attorney fees is different. I think the award of attorney fees is based upon, or an award of attorney fees can be based upon the relative disparity of the parties at a particular time. But here the factors, I believe, were statutory, and looking at the standard of living, looking at what the parties had done, looking at the short duration of this marriage, the court determined that maintenance was not appropriate under the circumstances.
But what about the asset issue? That was a factor too. I mean, whether mom had any assets, that I mean, I think that's a relevant factor unless you tell me otherwise.
In this case, there was never an issue from the outset, based on my review of the record, that suggested that there were any marital assets to be divided. Everything that the father had before he brought to the marriage, and they were not to be, there was no marital property to be divided.
Right, and mom doesn't challenge that. But mom is saying here she had no assets and no income. Dad had lots of assets and income, and the court, and focused on the court, made arguably inconsistent findings. I'm not prejudging this, I'm just saying it's arguably inconsistent. You know, it's hard, again, as we as an appellate court have to figure out what the court was thinking, and it's a little bit hard when the court says at one end, well, mom doesn't have anything and she depended on dad, and the other hand says, well, she'll make money so she doesn't need any maintenance. That's a little confusing when you're sitting here on a cold record.
At the time of the hearing, at the time of the permanent orders hearing, the father's income, his ability to earn money, was not substantially more than that of the wife. There had been a prior assertion of domestic violence in another court, which prohibited husband from going out and working, and the court specifically found he was not underemployed. He was older, he was looking for other things, but at the time of the permanent orders hearing, truly he did have more assets, but he didn't have more income, and the court did not impute additional income to him based upon the facts presented at trial.
But what about this issue? I know I've asked a couple of times, maybe we're not tracking, I apologize. This issue about the court saying on the one hand, mom doesn't have any assets, on the other hand saying she can earn a living.
Well,
isn't that inconsistent?
Well, it's not inconsistent to say that she doesn't have assets, but she can earn money in the future. And she can, I don't think that's inconsistent. I mean, she brought nothing to the marriage, and so she left with nothing. She had an ability to earn an income, and she was going to school, and the court recognized that she did have an ability to earn money in the future to support herself.
And last, I know I've taken a lot of your time. Is it accurate that for a maintenance determination under the statute that applied, you would have to look at the ability to earn income at the time as opposed to in the future, or is future earnings relevant?
Under subsection 4B, one of the considerations is that party's future earning capacity. That is or was in the statute at the time.
Well, let me ask you another aspect of the maintenance statute, the former maintenance statute, the threshold question of whether, as a threshold, mother had the ability to support her own needs. So the other considerations that court was making as far as what father could afford, that would come after an initial threshold consideration of whether mother could meet her basic needs. And so did the court make insufficient findings on that factor?
I did not know on this record. I wasn't prepared to address that. I can't answer that specifically, whether the court made specific findings or not with respect to that.
All right. Thank you.
I see my time is quickly running. If there are any other questions. One thing, I do appreciate the opportunity to appear. I used to always think that you were supposed to ask for oral argument, and in the most recent CLE, I was told that you shouldn't ask for it. But because the court's very busy, and I nevertheless appreciate the opportunity to appear.
I don't know what CLE that is.
I don't know what you
Not one I ever spoken at. We're delighted to have both of you here. So
thank you.
Yes, thank you. And Ms. Rouser, it looks like you have a little over a minute left.
Okay. At the outset, I just want to say there's not a question whether the court accepted the proposed parenting plan as was or modified it, because the proposed parenting plan is in the electronic record. I think at page 377 is exactly what the court rubber stamped. The reason that mother did not file anything is because mother did not know that this had all occurred, because she had never seen father's proposed parenting plan until the appeal was underway and she received the electronic record. There was no certificate of service signed. It was not served on mother. And in fact, it won't appear in the record, but I had to call the courthouse when I started thinking, realizing what had happened, and get the LexisNexis clerk to unlock father's proposed parenting plan so that I could access it and see what it said when I started to see what was happening. So
the order was not served on you either when it was signed?
The actual order was, but the reason that she didn't contest the timing, quite frankly, is because this court had found so overwhelmingly in favor of father that if that decision was based on the court's own rationale, you know, mother, it was a twofold problem, you know. Mother thought if that's what the court, if they changed their mind on their own initiative, then there really wasn't much that could be done.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank both of you for your excellent arguments today. Those arguments will be very helpful to the court in resolving this matter. So the matter will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.